This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Welcome to the World War One at Home podcast with me, Helen Mark. For terms and conditions, go to bbc.co.uk/podcasts. World War One at Home is a BBC project in partnership with Imperial War Museums, featuring stories linked to places across the UK and Ireland. From 2013, the team have travelled across the island of Ireland, gathering stories from every county. These have been broadcast on Radio Ulster and Radio Foyle and collected online as a permanent archive for future generations. On this Remembrance Sunday, which marks the 100th anniversary of the Armistice, we look back at some of those stories, reflecting the momentous events of 1914 to 18 and its aftermath. We start months before the outbreak of war, when Drumallis House in Larne became a centre for gun running for Sir Edward Carson's Ulster Volunteers in their bid to oppose Home Rule. Historian Eamon Phoenix takes up the story.
The key man behind the gun running at Larne, of course, was the Belfast businessman, Boer War veteran, Major Fred Crawford. Now, of course, Carson was a lawyer. The lawyer was always at odds, in a way, with the rebel in Edward Carson's persona. But he was eventually persuaded by Crawford for several reasons. Carson believed that a successful gun-running attempt, bringing guns from Germany to the north of Ireland, would be a major morale booster. But secondly, of course, it might persuade Asquith and the Liberal government to abandon their policy of including Ulster in a Home Rule Parliament. So we're told by Crawford of that famous meeting, that one-to-one in Carson's home in London, when he told Carson he needed his support. And Carson said, "Crawford, I'll see you through this business, even if I should have to go to prison for it." And Crawford famously replied, "Sir Edward, that's all I want. I go tonight." And that was to bring Fred Crawford, the gunrunner extraordinaire, to Hamburg, to his friend Bruno Spiro, to acquire the 35,000 Austrian and German rifles, which featured in the Larne gunrunning, and 3 million rounds of ammunition. He acquired a ship at Bergen in Norway. He was intercepted by the Danish customs. He had to flee through the Kiel Canal. That brings him to the North Sea, to South Wales, and eventually the guns are transferred to a coal boat once owned by Sir Samuel Kelly, the Belfast businessman, called the Clyde Valley. And that's what something like 12, 14,000 Ulster volunteers are waiting for on that night at Larne. We can see the harbour below where they gathered, something like 600 motor cars. Almost half the motor cars in the province of Ulster were commandeered that night. And of course, they rendezvoused right here at Drumallis House, and we're looking from the drawing room windows here, down on the lawns below, we can see the wide driveway coming up from the Antrim Coast Road. And this was a hive of activities, as all of these UVF drivers brought their cars here to be detailed to drive to the harbour. And there you had an amazing scene. Each UVF man was told to bring at least three sort of parcels of guns. Each contained five rifles. And from Larne Harbour that night, they were dispatched in the darkness along the roads of Ulster to the far-flung area like the Lagan in East Donegal, like Cavan, like the Lakes of Fermanagh. It all happened here.
Drumallis House in Larne. When the war started, recruitment to the armed forces became a priority. In 1915, an All-Ireland meeting, attended by prominent dignitaries of the day, tried to drum up support in Warren Point. Dr. Gavin Hughes is joined by David Olver, who reads the newspaper reports of the event at the time.
One of the main fears is actually that the Germans are going to invade Ireland. And certainly in the minds of the recruiting committees, this is something that they want to hammer home to the young lads who would have been in the crowd here today. Look, this town could end up being ashes from a German invasion, and you are the only people who can stop it.
The Lord Lieutenant thought it was now evident that the Germans had long plotted to subvert the liberties of Europe. Those who enlisted in the present crisis were setting a high example of devotion and patriotism. The need was very great, and the emergency was very urgent.
You know, the pressure begins to mount as the day wears on, that especially whenever Sergeant Michael O'Leary, Victoria Cross, is milling about the crowds, and there's quite a lot of men in khaki or in their dress uniforms, and you know, a man might begin to think, actually, I might be tempted to enlist.
The Lord Lieutenant, who was cordially received on rising, said that he derived the most sincere and unique pleasure from being present. He saw around him men from the north, the south, the east and the west of Ireland, all assembled for a common purpose. They had the Lord Mayor of Dublin. They also had, perhaps a stranger in these parts, the Lord Mayor of Cork. They had the Mayor of Derry and the High Sheriff of Belfast, as well as the High Sheriff of Dublin. The gathering contained representatives from all parts of Ireland, and they were met there for a common purpose: to present a common front to the enemy and to disappoint the Kaiser's hope that domestic dissensions would divide Englishmen or Irishmen in their determination to resist the aggression of his arms.
Warren Point in County Down. During the war, what is now Bentra Golf Course in Whitehead in Antrim became the first airship mooring station in Ireland. The airships were vital in protecting shipping from German U-boats and originally operated out of Luce Bay in Scotland, until the need arose to have a similar station on this side of the sea. Guy Warner from the Ulster Aviation Society explains how this came about.
The idea was simply that if an airship needed somewhere to land over on this side of the water, it parked at Bentra and then went back to Luce Bay as soon as possible. However, gradually they started over the course of 1916 through into 1917 to use the facilities slightly more often. Airship patrols were increased, convoys were introduced, and at Bentra there was an airship shed was constructed, and there was huts constructed on brick foundations to accommodate the ground crews for the airships. And it was established then that in the morning the Princess Maud would be escorted by airship from Larne to Stranraer or vice versa, and the same again in the evening. And if convoys were coming through from the north or heading out again the airship would patrol perhaps up as far as Rathlin or down towards the Copelands and escort the convoy. Every half hour or so the airship would send out a radio signal which would be triangulated by three radio stations in Scotland, here and Southern Ireland. So therefore, if it sighted a submarine, it could radio that it had spotted one. The naval staff would know pretty well where to send out the fishing vessels or the patrol vessels, and they could then either attack the submarine or chase it off. The wireless aerial was wound down from a reel, and this could actually be put to other useful purposes. Quite often what they did was, if they spotted some trawlers or drifters, they would fix a bucket to the end of the wire and would lower it down, and inside the bucket perhaps there'd be some tobacco or chocolate or maybe a newspaper or something like that. The fishermen would take these out and they'd put in some fish, and they'd wind the bucket up again and go home for tea. Over the course of 1917-1918, the airships patrolled extensively from Luce Bay and Bentra. There was an awful lot of traffic, particularly bringing over American soldiers who were on their way to France.
You're listening to the first part of a special Remembrance Sunday edition of World War I at Home with me, Helen Mark. Away from technology, the war saw other advances in human knowledge, particularly in the field of medicine. When cotton wool became in short supply due to its use in explosives, a new material was required to dress the wounds of injured soldiers. A replacement came in the form of sphagnum moss, which grows across the boglands of Ireland. This plant can absorb 20 times its weight in water and had antiseptic qualities. Dr. Clara Cullen visited the Bog of Allen in County Kildare.
The VAD and the College of Science became a central depot, and they organised networks of collecting centres all over Ireland, all over the island of Ireland, of sub-depots where the collecting centres sent their dried moss to be transported then by rail to Dublin, where they were treated, they were turned into bandages and other kinds of dressings, pads, cushions or whatever else, crated up and sent off to whatever military hospitals needed them. Three types were a very long-stemmed one, which was one identified as most appropriate for medical and surgical dressings. It was extremely absorbent and particularly antiseptic. The lower grades then were used for dysentery pads, and moss, which was not suitable for either, was used to make cushions that were used on hospital trains for stretchers and so on. And all of these things could be recycled. Well, they weren't one use only and disposable. The moss was collected by volunteers. An awful lot of them would have been women. There'd be church groups, girl guides. And then you got quite a number of locals who became involved. You get descriptions of elderly women bringing down sacks of moss from the mountain themselves, walking 5 miles, bringing the moss to one of these centres, working all day in the centre, and then walking home at night. It was cold, it was miserable, it was damp, and in the remote areas, it must have been incredibly challenging.
The Bog of Allen in County Kildare. From the fields to the Western Front. St Columb's Cathedral in Londonderry is home to the bass drum of the Hamilton Flute Band. The band became the regimental band of the 10th Battalion, the Royal Inniskilling Fusiliers, known as the Derries, and carried the drum to the Somme in France, one of the bloodiest battles of this or any war.
My name's Billy Cairns, and I've been a member of the Hamilton Flute Band from 1956. The band, when the First World War broke out, decided that they would join up, and they formed the regimental band of the 10th Battalion, the Royal Inniskilling Fusiliers. For instance, there would be a photograph. You can see the army uniforms, and you could see the drums, and you could see the bass drum, which became the communion drum. The padre put the linen over it, and it became the altar, and the communion was served from that drum. There was very little transport, really, and so the soldiers marched everywhere. And to the fore was the band. So they marched them from all around France. They marched them, actually, from Finnercamp in Ballyshannon, up through Lifford, Strabane, down into Londonderry. They had a recruiting day around about where the war memorial is now, and they took 24 hours rest then before they headed off and went to further training in England before they departed for France. That's how they got about, and even in France they marched from town to town, from area to area.
These were the original drums that went to France with the regiment in 1915. In the 1970s, the band presented them to the cathedral, and they have been on display in the chapter house since then.
We have a drum here in the cathedral that's over 100 years old, and it was played in such circumstances. And of course, the band members weren't really soldiers as such. However, they were the stretcher bearers, and they've seen some awful sights.
St Columb's Cathedral in Derry. You can listen to all these stories in full on our website. Go to bbc.co.uk/World War I and look for World War I at Home. You can also download our stories as podcasts via your favourite app.